Hello and welcome to another edition of Korea 24. It's Thursday, the 15th of July, and I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. South Korea has recorded over 1,600 new COVID-19 cases for the second day, but health authorities have confirmed 35 million vaccine doses are on the way. We'll have the latest in our news briefing shortly. Two presidential contenders for the main opposition People Power Party have pledged to dissolve the Ministry of Gender and Equality, and the leader of the PPP has suggested the Unification Ministry should also be considered. We'll explore this controversial debate for our in-depth later. And then, if you love the colour purple, you'll want to stick around for Explore Korea, where we'll find out more about two islands in the South Cholla province known as the Purple Islands. Let's begin Korea 24. The number of South Korea's new daily COVID-19 cases dipped slightly from the previous day's record, but only by 15 cases. To give us the latest update on the continuing fourth wave of infections and other headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us a KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hello, Hee-jin.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So the official tally has dipped from the previous day's record high, but we have concerns that the infection seems to be spreading to regions other than the Greater Seoul area. Mm-hmm. So first of all, can you break down the figures for us first?
Well, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said that the nation added 1,600 new patients to tested positive, down from the previous day's record-setting figure of 1,615, bringing its cumulative caseload to 173,511. It is the second highest daily count and the ninth consecutive day the daily figure has stayed above the 1,000 mark. And we have preliminary figures for Thursday as well. As of 6 p.m., the KDCA reported 1,192 new infections, 71 less than 6 p.m. Wednesday. Nearly 30% of the new infections occurred further away from the greater capital region, indicating that the fourth wave is indeed spilling over. Most regions outside the greater Seoul area began enforcing tougher level 2 social distancing protocols on Thursday. The capital and its closest cities remain under the strictest level 4 regulations. The vaccination task force announced on Thursday that it will provide 35 million doses of vaccines by the end of August, and another 42 million doses are on its way by September.
Yes, hopefully that will help reach the government's target of vaccinating 70% of the population with at least one dose of the vaccine by September. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, we have reports that six crewmen aboard a South Korean naval destroyer serving an anti-piracy mission overseas have been diagnosed with COVID-19, raising concerns about a possible cluster within the vessel. Can you tell us more?
Yes, South Korea's Joint Chief of Staff said on Thursday that six members of the 300-strong Cheonghae unit on board a 4,000-ton naval destroyer Munmu the Great tested positive for the virus. President Moon Jae-in ordered the immediate deployment of quarantine and medical personnel, as well as deliveries of medical supplies to the destroyer currently on a mission to protect South Korean vessels against pirates operating off the coast of Africa. If the situation on the vessel or in the nearby region does not allow the required treatment, Moon ordered that the patients be repatriated as soon as possible. The JCS said tests will be conducted on all 300 service members on board, as some 80 are showing symptoms under a cohort isolation. The 34th contingent of the unit left South Korea in February, and all its members have yet to be vaccinated.
Let's turn to other headlines now. The former Board of Audit and Inspection Chairman Choi Jae-young, considered a likely presidential contender, has joined the main opposition People Power Party, possibly signalling the start of efforts to put forth a single contender from the opposition faction. So he has now joined the party then.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Choi joined the party immediately after meeting with PPP leader Lee Jun-seok at the party headquarters on Thursday, 17 days after he resigned from his post as head of BAI. The PPP has been in contact with independent contenders such as Choi and former Prosecutor General Yoon Sung-yeol, seeking to run in the race in on an opposition platform. And the PPP has been trying to bring these opposition forces together and present a single candidate to run in the election. Yoon, who has yet to commit to a political party, saw his support slip below 30% for the first time in 4 months amid controversy surrounding him and his family. A Real Meter survey of 2,036 adults held nationwide Monday and Tuesday showed that approval for the vocal critic of the incumbent administration fell 4.5 percentage points from 3 weeks earlier to 27.8%. Yoon's approval rating in the latest survey also lies within the margin of error, with Gyeonggi Province Governor Lee Jae-myung, who garnered 26.4%, up 3.6 percentage points from the 3 weeks earlier. The survey commissioned by Umma News had a confidence level of 95%, with a margin of error or of plus or minus 2.2 percentage points.
Moving on to fiscal policy news now, a member of the Bank of Korea's Monetary Policy Board proposed raising the key interest rate from an all-time low of 0.5%, saying the nation's recovery momentum required the central bank to address the possibility. Can you elaborate on what was said?
Indeed. Following the committee's decision to continue the freeze on Thursday, BOK Governor Lee Ju-yeol revealed that the board member Ko Seung-bom suggested increasing the rate by a quarter percentage point. This is the first time anyone on the Monetary Board has brought up the possibility since the bank slashed the rates back in May last year and kept the rates unchanged throughout 8 meetings. Lee said despite the COVID-19 resurgence, the adjustment should be reviewed considering the recovery momentum, inflation and cumulative financial imbalance. The BOK governor said he believes that the time has come to review whether it should be appropriate to adjust the current easing of a monetary policy at the next meeting. And resurgence or no, Lee expects the nation's economic growth this year to meet the central bank's previous forecast of 4%.
We'll close out our news briefing there. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Last week, two presidential contenders, Yoo Sung-min and Ha Tae-kyung, for the main opposition People Power Party, caused a stir when they both made campaign pledges to abolish the Gender Equality Ministry. The controversy was further stoked by the young head of the PPP, Lee Jun-suk, who also agreed with their assessment that there's no need for the ministry. And then he caused even further controversy by questioning the need for another ministry as well, the Unification Ministry. Although there's been backlash from both outside and within the party, the debate has been stoked to reassess the purpose of these two ministries. To carry out our own discussion today, we have joining us on the line two political commentators and regular guests on our show. First, we have Law Professor Cho Hee-kyung from Hongik University joining us on the line. Hello, Professor Cho. Hope you're doing well.
Hello.
We also have Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-joo from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies on the line as well. Professor Kim, hello as well.
Hi.
Now, Professor Chul, could you first give us a brief history on the Gender Equality Ministry? We should point out that the full English name is the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family, but actually the Korean name is the Yeosung Gajokbu, which directly translated means Ministry for Women and Family. Now, can you tell us what were its goals and how effective do you think the ministry has been in achieving these goals?
The ministry began its life originally as a Special Women's Council under the Noteu government. This was just after we had the new constitution in 1987, which actually enshrined as a duty on the part of the state to promote the welfare of women and their basic rights. This is in Article 34 of Korean Constitution, and they established this kind of interministerial, special council, but it really wasn't very effective at all. And globally, there was a watershed moment at the Beijing Women's Conference in 1995. That was the fourth women's conference that was held under the UN auspices. And there, they really sort of set the global agenda for promotion of women's rights and gender equality. Mm. And as a result, many countries set up or adopted this kind of ministry. So within the OECD, for example, most of the member states do have similar ministries. In the G7 also, Germany and Canada have specific women's ministries that's quite large, and four other countries have at least a ministerial level representative who looks at this issue. In Korea, the women's ministry or the Ministry of Gender Equality is only about 20 years old. So this special council was then changed under Kim Dae-jung administration to Ministry for Women. And then it sort of went through some sort of phases of change. So at times, some of the welfare ministry parts were added to it. It was taken away and then sort of re-added. So in fact, the current form of women's ministry in Korea actually was established under Lee Myung-bak government, because back then there was also a serious attempt to abolish the Ministry of Women using the same kind of arguments as they are doing now. But eventually they decided against it, but they did reduce the scope very significantly. And then it became augmented with the family part yet again. So it's been through lots of iterations, and it's certainly not the first time, the call to abolish the women's ministry has been made.
Right. Professor Kim, presidential hopeful Yoo Sung-min said the ministry has failed in its objectives and that there is no need for a ministry that only serves half the population, that other ministries together can tackle the issue of gender inequality. Ha Tae-young, meanwhile, said the gender ministry has in fact become an organ that instigates gender-related tensions. What do you make of these criticisms, Professor? And what do you make of the ministry's activities over the past 20 years?
I think there are several different dimensions about this issue here. And one, I think, is the actual performance of the existing ministry we're talking about on one hand. So how good has this ministry been doing its job? So does it justify its continuation or not? There's a one question. And then more fundamental question about whether we need a ministry that represents half of the population here. And on the first part, the performance, if you look at its organizational chart, of course, it's a very relatively, as a ministry, it's a small ministry, and it has different divisions, and it has a women's policy, obviously, but it has also youth policy, family policy, and then rights promotion, women's and youth rights promotion. And here, what kind of things have they done recently? I think the opposition has a lot of doubts on one hand. And of course, there's a lot that can be said. And people can say, well, this kind of work can be done under a welfare ministry, or even, instead of addressing the question of half of the population here, maybe we need a whole new kind of ministry that promotes human rights and human protection. There could be all different arguments that could be exchanged here. For example, women, half the population, and the family. These days, we have a lot of single-person household. And so, about the family itself, there is not a solid agreement about it. Rather, if we have a ministry that promotes human rights and human well-being, including families and the single household, single-person household, and LGBT, different minorities, and so on. Some people, seem to believe that that would be actually better function rather than just a family. That seems to be a little bit of traditional concept here. And then women, just half of the population.
Sure. Professor Chua, a survey carried out by the Korea Society Opinion Institute, commissioned by TBS, showed that public opinion is largely split on whether the ministry should be dissolved. 48.6% that it should, while 39.8% said it should not. The survey was carried out between July 9th and 10th on 1,014 adults, and it had a 95% confidence level with a plus or minus 3% error. Now, presidential hopeful for the ruling Democratic Party, Lee Nak-yeon, said that although he does not believe that the ministry should be abolished, he thinks readjusting the role of the ministry is needed. Professor Cho, what do you think, whether there is a need for the gender equality ministry and whether there might perhaps need to be a change?
So, as Professor Kim said, we are addressing two different questions. One is whether the ministry is doing its job effectively, and second, whether the ministry has run its course in terms of achieving its objectives, and it should be just gotten rid of. But the way that the opposition politicians and also the opposition party leader has couched this argument, I thought was really sort of the worst kind of dog whistle politics, because if the women's ministry or the gender equality ministry is not doing its job that well, and certainly lots of ministries merit criticisms, that's something separate. But are they claiming by arguing that gender equality ministry should be abolished that gender equality actually has been achieved in Korean society? Nobody would say that. Nobody would agree with that. I think even those politicians. So this recent campaign by Yoo Sung-min, Ha Tae-kyung, and Lee Jun-suk adding his voice is really a calculated campaign aimed at the so-called idenam, male young males in their 20s, kind of deliberately exploiting their dissatisfaction and the kind of reverse discrimination that they feel they suffer in the current Korean society. Certainly, I think there are improvements that can be made to how the Ministry of Gender Equality is performing. But, just as an example, the support center for digital sex crime victims has been established by this particular ministry. Without the ministry, I don't think it could have been done within the time period that we are talking about. There were certainly much more significant issues of gender equality, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when this ministry actually came into being. Things like, getting rid of Ho Joo-jae, the head of family, requirement in the civil code itself. Lots of structural and systemic discrimination and inequalities that existed in the law, in the customs, just those things that they were able to be addressed more effectively because you had a ministry that actually concerned itself with those particular issues. I think the real problem with the Ministry of Gender Equality is that they are not given enough resources and the tools that are necessary to do their job. If they were actually given the resources necessary to, for example, address a single parent problem or the failure to pay child support payments by errant fathers, I think those issues could be much more effectively addressed. But currently, the ministry simply doesn't have the resources or the capacity to address those things. So I think, we should actually bolster the ministry and its role and its jurisdiction rather than abolish it.
Professor Kim, what do you think? Do you think there is perhaps the ministry hasn't been given enough resources? And what do you make of this argument that these politicians have called for the ministry to be dissolved are looking, in fact, just to win over young male voters in their 20s and 30s who do feel that there's reverse discrimination against them? Is that too cynical a reading of the situation?
I guess you asked three different questions, but to answer those all, I suppose. I agree with Professor Cho about the fact that this current Ministry of Gender Equality has indeed achieved a lot in the past. Long time ago, however, introducing new family systems, getting rid of hojuja and so on, those are good, great achievements. But in recent years, a lot of people feel that this ministry has been ineffective in addressing real women's rights questions and then big, high-profile, sex violations, very sensitive political issues and so on. So there is a legitimate ground for arguing for, these conservatives, they're talking about, I'm not trying to, taking side with them wholeheartedly, but they're talking about small government. And if they can close down some of the ministries that no longer serves as much of the purpose of it, and I agree that some of these ministries that they're talking about, their functions can be merged with other ministries and still the government can do a good job rather than just keeping the ministry under the name that represents only half of the population.
We have to move on to the Unification Ministry now. We don't have that much time today, so I'll ask you both at once each. The PPP leader, Lee Jun-seok, suggested that the Unification Ministry should be considered for abolishment as well. He explained that there may be inefficiencies as unification and security exist in the larger framework of diplomacy, and therefore it should be handled by the foreign ministry. He added that the presidential office and the state spy agency have also generally handled cross-border issues. Professor Kim, what do you make of these comments?
I think this has a similarity with the issue that we talked about, Ministry of Gender Equality, the Ministry of Unification. I think the conservative politicians are raising more issue about the performance of the current ministries under the current government, and they have feeling against the way the ministry has been kind of put in there to help North Korea when they have a lot of issues that they feel strongly against. And especially the current minister, Lee In-young, his background and his inclination and so on, the conservatives don't feel that this is the way the government should go. Of course, legal scholars, I wonder what Professor Cho would say, but there's a constitutional issue, of course. North Korean affairs is not a foreign affairs. It's North Korea is technically territory of South Korea. Therefore, the argument that we need a separate ministry on North Korean affairs has a firm ground right there. Mm. But overall, what can we do about it? Kind of like a similar way, the security issues and the policy issues, they can be dealt with by other ministries as well. So if you're really a firm believer of small government, it makes sense for you to say we should get rid of the Ministry of Gender Equality, we should get rid of a Ministry of Unification. We can seek smaller government that still does a better job doing necessary work. That's what I would say.
Professor Zhu?
I think we have to sort of look at what a small government actually means. The current Conservative Party seems to believe that small government means basically you just have to get rid of ministries and reduce the number of people who are working for the government. But that's not necessarily the real sort of aim or the purpose of small government. Small government is about letting the market or the private sector do what it can do much more effectively. But government has a proper role. And, there are certain things that you can't just leave to the private sector. So in terms of Unification Ministry, the argument is that, things that it does, the foreign ministry could also do. But if we remember the fact that, the main partner for our foreign ministry is really the United States. They are our main, the partner or the one that we really have to deal most with in terms of diplomatic relations.
I think Professor Cho is going off the track big time here. Minister of Foreign Affairs, where I worked before, deals with all countries around the world, and your argument is just going too far here. And basically, I think the conservatives, what they have in mind, I'm not taking full stance with the argument that we should get rid of the Unification Ministry here. But, those people who support small government side, they are saying we cannot set up ministries for all these issues altogether. I'm going back to the gender equality here. But we cannot set up ministries for scientists. We cannot set up separate ministries for, you know,
that's
like a small
group.
That's not
true. I mean, we have a ministry for science.
Professor,
we have
ministry
for science, technology, and information and communication.
Different vocational
Professor
groups,
Kim?
Different minority groups. My apologies. There was a wrong choice of word. But, you know, there are different social groups, different groups within the society.
I would like to remind the Conservative Party that the current, you know, configuration of the ministries that are actually in existence were, in fact, set up under Lee Myung-bak government. And, you know, back then, there was also huge debate about getting rid of these two particular ministries. And in the end, they decided to keep them because they saw the necessity of it. Now, to make them really effective, you know, you need to resource them properly. We can't deny that they have their role. But if you don't give them proper tools to do their job, how can we expect them to be able to do their job?
Professor Cho, Professor Kim, unfortunately, we have to leave it there, but it has been a fascinating discussion, which perhaps we will touch upon again. We've been speaking to Professor Cho Hee-kyung from Hongik University and Professor Kim Pyeong-joo from the Hanguk University of Foreign Studies. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
We continue on now to our Special Olympics segment, Going for Gold. Here until the Tokyo 2020 Olympics start, we'll be previewing the event and some of South Korea's best medal prospects. And then once the Olympic torch is lit, we will bring you daily updates and results. Helping us do all that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who has joined me now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's great to see you.
Good to see you too.
Now, over the last couple of days, we talked about archery, fencing and shooting. Today, I understand we have another sport that, like archery, the competition for places among Team Korea has been especially tough.
Absolutely. And that is golf, another powerhouse sport, specifically women's golf, that South Korea is highly anticipated to grab gold in. Team Korea will be coached by Choi Kyung-ju and Park Se-ri, both of whom were coaches at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
Yes, it's no secret, of course, how dominant Korean women have been in golf over the years. And that, of course, includes the first gold medal in golf in the modern era at the last Olympics in Rio. But we will get to that later.
Mm-hmm.
Let's first talk about the qualification process and how that worked, because it did seem a little complicated for the uninitiated.
Yeah, for me, definitely. I actually had to learn a bit about it. So the Olympic qualification is based off of two things. The International Golf Federation, or the IGF, which is the world governing body over the sport, and the athlete's world ranking. That's going to play a huge part. Those two elements determine who makes the cut. Now, a total of 60 athletes will compete in each of the men's and women's events. So that's 60 men's, 60 women's. The top 15 world-ranked players automatically make it in, but there's a limit to just 4 players per country. Beyond the top 15, who are automatically in, the remaining 45 slots will also be filled based on world rankings. And that, in that case, only up to 2 athletes can come from each country. With that said, Team Korea has 4 women who are in the top 15 in the world, so that means all 4 are going in. That's not the case for the men's side, but we still have 2 to enter the mix based off of their world rankings.
Okay, so let's dive into the women's side first. 4 players ranked in the top 15 in the world. In fact, currently, I believe, all 4 players are in the top 5 as well, which is quite incredible. So it shows how much of a powerhouse these women are for Team Korea.
Power and experience to boot. The 4 will be Park In-bi, Ko Jin-young, Kim Se-young, and Kim Hyo-ju. Park is the defending Olympic champ after grabbing the gold at the 2016 Rio Olympics, just like you said. When the sport returned to the Games after 112 years, she's seeking to defend her title this time around. And this will be Kim Se-young's second Olympics. And yes, the amount of experience Team Korea is bringing is incredible. Between the 4 athletes, they won a combined 44 LPGA victories, 11 of which were won at major tournaments. And Go just won her first LPGA title this season, just some 20 days ahead of the Games. She was only dethroned from the number 1 rank in the world, sitting atop for 100 weeks. I'm just glad they're on our side. Jeez, my goodness.
Yeah, simply just an incredible record. We have to quickly move on to the men's side of things now. You said we have two athletes, right?
Yes, that is Im Sung-jae and Kim Chiu. But they're no slouches either, of course. Finishing eighth at the Rocket Mortgage Classic earlier this month, Im's been in the top 10 in multiple tournaments this season. He was also named the PGA's 2019 Rookie of the Year. And Kim is a PGA Tour veteran as well, who won the 2017 Players' Championship at just 21 at the time, becoming the youngest to ever win the event.
Okay, let's talk about who Team Korea is up against. We only have time for one, so let's just delve into the women's event.
Okay, now we're talking about opponents. We have to address Team USA with the Korda sisters, that's Nelly and Jessica, Korean-American Daniel Kang, and Lexi Thompson. Between them, those four, they roped in 28 LPGA victories with three from major tournaments. There's also U.S. Open champion Yuka Saso from the Philippines, and the incredibly dangerous Korean-New Zealander Lydia Ko, who you talked about on the show before, who's also in the top 15 of the world. And the home ground defenders, Japan, will be playing with tenacity, of course, especially Nasa Hataoka, who is 11th in the world, and she has three LPGA wins under her belt and was runner-up at this year's U.S. Open. So it's really going to get heated. The men's round will run from July 29th to August 1st, and the women's from August 4th to the 7th.
Yeah, so some fierce competition, but it would be disappointing still for Team Korea not to pick up a medal or two, especially
Please.
For the women. But
I'm terrified. They're so, like, their stats are crazy.
Yeah. Sure, no pressure though, but yes, it is expected. That's where we'll leave it for today's Going for Gold. Thank you for bringing us that preview, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 21.41 points, or 0.66% on Thursday, closing the day at 3,286.22. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 9.33 points, or 0.89%, to close at 1,054.31. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 7 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,141.5 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
It's time now to round up some of the other news stories that have been attracting attention online in Korea today. It is our daily segment, Korea Trending, and with those stories for us is Lee Ju-young, who joins us on the line. Ju-young, hello.
Hi, Jung-ho.
So what topics do you have for us today?
Our first story is about new information on the suspension of the KBO's regular season. We then talk about the excavation of some very well-preserved human remains of an exceptionally tall man from Korea's Three Kingdom period. Our last story is about the manufacturing, sales, and subsequent backlash of a fully functional firearm modified to resemble a toy gun.
Okay, let's get started with our first story then. We previously have covered the KBO's regular season suspension, but I understand you have an update now.
Sure. New information came out regarding the recent suspension of the Korea Baseball Organization's regular season, which was announced Monday, due to multiple players from the NC Dinos and the Doosan Bears having contracted COVID-19. On Wednesday, officials from Gangnam-gu District Office asked police to open an investigation into some of the Dinos players for allegedly giving false information during contact tracing. Currently, a new round of epidemiological investigation is underway on the said players.
Okay, so some NC Dinos players allegedly giving false contact tracing information. Who were these players and what happened exactly?
Right. So four players from the NC Dinos, who are Park Seong-min, Park Min-woo, Kwon Hee-dong, and Lee Myung-gi, invited two women from outside to have a drinking party at a hotel room on early Tuesday morning. You see, this itself is a violation of current social distancing rules that ban private gatherings of more than four people. And on the next day, the two women were confirmed to have COVID-19. After getting tested, it turned out that three of the four athletes present at the drinking party tested positive for the virus, except for Park Min-woo, as he had been vaccinated ahead of his participation in the Olympics. But the problem worsened when two athletes from the Doosan Bears also got infected after playing a game with the Dinos. Our show talked about that particular game previously. Now, Park Seong-min apologized and admitted breaking quarantine regulations. And Pang Min-woo, who was set to play in the Olympics, dropped out in light of this incident.
Right, so not only has this terrible lapse in judgment gotten them in legal trouble, potentially, Pang Min-woo has lost his place in the Olympics as well.
Yeah.
Now, you said earlier that the KBO suspended their regular season due to these cases popping up. When can we expect to see the league playing again?
Most likely from August 10th. Originally, the league was planning to go on a break from next Monday so selected KBO players can compete in the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. Despite the suspension of the regular season, the KBO said that it intends to play the All-Star game at Gocheok Sky Dome in Seoul on the 24th of this month.
Right, so the All-Star game is going ahead, but with this whole situation and with no fans in the stands, I'm not sure how much of a celebration it will feel like. Let's move on to our second story of the day now. What are we looking at?
Ancient remains of a relatively tall man were discovered in a tomb from the Silla period in the city of Gyeongju, which is located in the far eastern corner of North Gyeongsang province. The remains date back some 1,500 years ago and are in very good condition. The Korea Cultural Heritage Foundation said today that it conducted an excavation survey at the ruins of Tapdong in Gyeongju, where Silla tombs are concentrated, and found the skeleton that is considered to be the tallest among the confirmed human remains at 180 centimeters from the Three Kingdom periods, which extends from 57 BC to 668 AD. The foundation said that the average height of males during that time was about 165 centimeters.
Yes, 180 centimeters is about 5 foot 11. So even by today's standards, that is quite tall.
Yes.
It's very interesting indeed. I understand that's not all that was noteworthy from this find, Jiang.
An interesting fact about these remains is that it looks like the body was stuffed into a coffin as the face is not facing the sky, and the feet were also laid in a very unnatural position. Also, the spine was deformed like that of a person suffering from a disc issue. There were, however, no artifacts that could help infer this man's occupation. The Gyeongju National Research Institute of Cultural Heritage said it will work with the CHA to conduct anthropology and pathology research on the remains to better understand life and environment of the Silla period. The foundation also plans to use the skull to restore his face and compare it to that of modern people.
So it seems there's still much to learn and discover, which is, I guess, all part of the fun of this kind of discovery, of course. I believe there were other bodies discovered as well, Jiang.
Right. In this excavation survey, 24 tombs and 12 skeletal remains from the 5th to 6th centuries were identified. However, other than the 180-centimeter man we've been focusing on, the others were not as well preserved. Most of the burial items were earthenware, while only a few ornaments and ironware were found.
Okay, so the tall man himself was the major find. Okay, let's move on to our final story now. I understand it's an international one, Jiang.
Right. A U.S. gunmaker has been embroiled in controversy over their sales of a handgun modified to resemble a toy gun made of Lego blocks. The U.S.-based gunmaker Culper Precision unveiled its modified Glock firearm, the Block 19, on its website and social media last month and said that, quote, "This is just one small way to break the rhetoric from anti-gun folks and draw attention to the fact that shooting sports are super fun." The fully functional firearm is encased in parts that resemble Lego blocks and also has actual toy blocks attached, strong enough to withstand force when the weapon is fired.
And understandably, this gun has received immense backlash. What kind of criticism has it received?
Okay. The Washington Post criticized the launch, citing that thousands of children unintentionally shoot themselves or others. Other critics also heavily condemned the product, saying that, quote, "This is the most irresponsible gun modification and cannot understand why and how anyone could find this amusing in the slightest." However, the gun company's president, Brandon Scott, said that the design was all about exposing the fun of shooting and that he was fulfilling a childhood fantasy for his adult customers. While he acknowledged that children might think these particular guns are toys, it didn't dissuade his stance, and he went on to say that if the child of one of his customers finds a Lego modified gun and shoots himself with it, it will be the customer's fault, and that he expects every gun owner to keep the guns locked up.
However, thankfully, this is where the Lego company itself steps in. They had some to say on the matter, didn't they?
They sure did. And in the form of a cease and desist letter. Scott decided to comply after his lawyer reportedly told him that the toy giant might have a case against his company if he kept selling the gun. Lego also told the media that the gun company has agreed to remove the product from their website and not make or sell anything similar in the future. About 20 such guns have been sold before Lego contacted the gun maker.
Yes, and I would argue that those guns should be recalled as well if they haven't already. Mm-hmm. But at least the sale of this gun has now been stopped. That's where we'll leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Jung-an. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.
Welcome back. We've now come to our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we journey across the peninsula, discovering more about some of the country's history, culture, and travel hotspots that people can enjoy. Helping us do that this week, we have joining us on the line our travel expert, Hannah Roberts, from the travel, culture, and history blog, Moonbear Travel. Hannah, hello, and welcome back. Hope you're doing well.
Hi, thank you.
So, Hannah, where are you taking us this week?
So last time I introduced everyone to a big island off the south coast of Korea, but this week I thought I would take us down to two very small but very colorful islands in Shinan County off the west coast of Korea in South Jeolla province. They're called Panwoldo and Pakjido, and they're famous for being entirely purple.
Okay, entirely purple, you say. What do you mean by that, and how and why is it purple?
So I think it's safe to say that the world loves its colourful villages, the blue town Shifshuan in Morocco and Mexico's all-yellow Pueblo Mágico. Even Korea already has a top tourist hotspot in the shape of Busan's rainbow-coloured Kamchang cultural village. Panwoldo and Pakjido already had a purple bridge in 2007, but after negative news surrounding some of the salt farms of Shinan County came out in 2014, the two islands who were uninvolved in the scandal, they were one for visitors and a new image.
Mm.
So it was a choice move around 6 years ago to paint the whole island purple. One of the native flowers of the region is the purple bellflower. So if you combine that with the pre-existing purple bridge, there was obviously no question about which color to go. Farmers have started growing purple kohlrabi and beet, keeping on brand with the purple project. And the local government, they even planted 30,000 purple asters and 21,500 square feet of lavender fields. The rejuvenation has proved successful as well. Since 2018, the islands have seen around 500,000 visitors, with 100,000 of them visiting between June and August last year.
Okay, that does sound like it would be quite a sight to see. So right. If we are visiting these purple islands then, what can visitors expect to do there?
The best thing to do on Panwoldo and Pakjido is definitely to take lots and lots of photos. You know, that's why they painted it purple, for people to snap away and to share it with everyone else. You can visit the flower fields they planted. You can stop for more photos in purple phone booths and walk the long purple bridges between the islands. They are tiny, with a total of only 150 residents between them, but that makes them perfect to just take your time walking along the special purple trail, taking in the purple sights, and eating at one or both, if you're hungry enough, of the two new restaurants built purposefully for the new wave of visitors. Or you can even stay a night in the all-purple hotel on Panwoldo so that you can stay until the sun goes down and you can see the bridge on the ocean light up at night.
Yes, it definitely sounds very Instagrammable, shall we say. I think you'd quite a few unique shots there. So how can visitors get to the island if you're coming from Seoul?
The islands are pretty remote, so it's not a simple journey, especially if you want to go by public transport. If you do want to go that route, you'll need to take the train or the bus to Mokpo, catch a bus to Anjua intersection on Anjua Island, and then get another bus to the start of the Purple Bridge. By my estimate, the journey would take between 6 and 8 hours, depending on which transport you take down to Mokpo. Mm. By comparison, driving there from Seoul will take around 6 hours. It's worth noting also that you can't drive or get dropped off directly on the islands. Cars are not allowed. So if you're driving, you'll have to park in the designated car park at the start of the bridge. All in all, neither journey sounds the most fun, but one silver lining, literally, at the end of it all, is that if you wear something purple, you can get onto the islands for free. Otherwise, it has a 3,000 won entry fee for adults.
I see. That's about $2.50 US only. But free, yeah, if you're wearing something purple, as you said. It is quite a commitment, it seems, to get to the islands then, but it doesn't cost
Definitely.
A lot to actually enter. So considering that it's not the easiest place to reach, perhaps the best way to visit is by making it part of an itinerary of a longer weekend visiting the region itself. So with that in mind then, Hannah, can you recommend for us a couple of other things that we can do in the area as well?
Of course. If you're visiting Purple Islands, that means you're in the real southwest part of Korea in South Jeolla province. Well, I feel like South Jeolla is maybe one of the lesser visited areas of Korea because of its distance from Seoul and because it's a bit tricky to get around without a car, because of its mountains and wibbly-wobbly coastline and literally thousands of islands. Just like the rest of the country, it has some fantastic spots to visit.
Mm.
The capital of the region is the Muan Township, which is famous for its protected mudflats, which you can't walk on, but you can walk through when the tide is low enough. And the pathway is revealed by the receding water. They even have a festival for the flats in mid-August when you can see them covered with lotus plants that famously grow in the murkiest waters.
Right, I understand the mudflats are quite a sight to see indeed.
Just like the mudflats, most of the best spots to visit in the region are natural. There is the famous Jungnobwan, the bamboo forest in Tamyang, where you can walk 8 different trails through bamboo plants, drink green tea grown in bamboo dew, so poetic, and visit historically significant buildings from the world of Joseon poetry. There are also the Boseon green tea fields, in particular the Daehan Dawon tea plantation, which is the largest in Korea and the only one to be recognized as a tourist tea plantation. It's especially famous, you've maybe seen photos, for its tiered fields, which have a view over the sea.
Right, right. I understand there are some historic places to visit as well in the region.
There are. There's the Myeongnyang Strait, where one of the most famous naval battles in history was fought by Admiral Yi Sun-shin, and one of the most popular summer cities, Yeosu, is in this region, where you can ride the cable car over the bay and you can visit the Hyanggaeram Hermitage, for a beautiful view over the Korea Strait.
Right. We've, of course, learned all about Yeosu and Admiral Yi Sun-shin in an early episode of Explore Korea with Ali as well, from your blog as well. We've also talked about Hyanggaeram before. It's clear that this southern region has an endless list of beautiful places to check out. So finally, as ever with any place to visit, discovering the local delicacies and foods is always an important part of travelling. So, Hannah, what can you recommend for us while we are down there?
If you're a foodie, you'll want to try the 3 main dishes of the region, which are unogui, which is grilled sweet fish, popularly seasoned with garlic, chilies, ginger, pepper, and sesame. I'm not a fish person, but that sounds great to me. as well as Gwangyang bulgogi, which is a variation on the famous dish where the meat is sliced thinner and cooked until it's only just done. And finally, there's the Tamyang special called Daetongbap, which is where they cook rice and other grains. They steam it inside a bamboo trunk.
Sounds fantastic. My mouth is watering already. That is where we'll leave it, though, for this week's Explore Korea, learning about the Purple Islands, Panwoldo and Pakjido and more. Hannah, thank you for introducing us to these islands, and we look forward to having you on again for Explore Korea. Take care.
Thank you. See you next time.
And that's all for our show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, so do join us again then. Till then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great day. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.